Chuck Missler used to say that the Bible could be described as a tale of two cities. How many, is it Tolkien who wrote that? Who wrote that, the tale of two cities? I don't know. It's a really important book that you got to study when you go to college. I know that. And yeah, it's tedious reading, but I think that the Bible is aptly described as kind of a tale of two cities. So what two cities? Well, Fernley and no. It would be Jerusalem, God's city, and then there's kind of an ante-city. That's Babylon. Before we get to chapter 13, I don't think we'll get to chapter 14 tonight, but I want to kind of take us all around this city called Babylon. We have our map up there first, Blake. Here's to get an idea. This is about 600-ish or so B.C. Here's the Babylonian Empire. There was a smaller version of the Babylonian Empire under Hammurabi and such, but this is really one of the first great world empires. I know that there were other empires that had significant reach and scope, but the Bible concerns itself, of course, with those nations and those empires that affected Israel directly. Babylon was really the first one. Look what they did. Under Nabopolassar and his boy Nebuchadnezzar, look what they extended their power to. All the way up the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, around through Judah and Judea, into Egypt, up into modern-day Turkey. See where it says Lydia, that's modern-day Turkey. Notice the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. Notice how the yellow sort of borders make a kind of a crescent. And of course, those who hold to Muhammad and the teachings of the Quran, the Fertile Crescent is often referred to as the cradle of civilization. We're all, duh, that's the book of Genesis, that's where it says. Where Babylon was on the Tigris-Euphrates River, that's modern-day Iraq. And very likely, because the Euphrates is one of the boundaries of the Garden of Eden, somewhere in that section right there was the Garden of Eden. Hit our go button, Blake. Here's where Baghdad is today, the capital of Iraq. About 70 or so-ish miles to the south is where Babylon used to be. I think I got some more pictures. You ready, Blake? What else we got here? Remember, you see where Judah is, Israel. Remember when the prophet Jonah, God says, I want you to go to Nineveh. It was that way. He gets on a boat and goes to Tarshish, which would be west across the Mediterranean, the exact opposite direction. Why is Nineveh important? We'll see here in a minute. Guess, well, it was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. Pretty rough group of folks there. But we'll see here in just a minute where Babylon starts, where Babylon and Nineveh start. Don't go to the next slide yet. Would you make your way over to the book of Genesis chapter 10? Genesis chapter 10. Do you like audiovisual? I do. I like to see where stuff is. Let's go to chapter 10 and let's see where the ante-city gets its start from. Are you in Genesis chapter 10? Or after the flood, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah and Mrs. Noah, and their boys, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and their wives, are coming out of the boat. The entire planet has been scrubbed practically of all air-breathing mammals. Why is that? Well, because the enemy was listening in the Garden of Eden when God said, well, here's how we're going to fix this sin after Adam and Eve had eaten the fruit. Your seed, Eve, is going to crush his head. But your seed, Nakosh, is going to bruise his heel. Lucifer was paying attention. What did he try to do? He tried to pollute, literally, the bloodline of Eve. That's when some demons somehow manifested and went into the daughters of men, and freakish giants were born, the Nephilim. So what God has to do is he has to scrub the entire surface of the earth. Why? So that there will never be any alternate claim of anyone other than Jesus the Messiah to say, I am literally of the purest bloodline. a fascinating detail there in Genesis chapter 6. Noah was perfect in his generations. Well, anyway, the flood has come and gone. Now they're getting out of the boat. Chapter 10, Genesis, verse 1. Now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The sons were born to the end. Sons were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth were Gomer. That's mentioned in the book of Ezekiel. Magog and Madai. And then it goes on. If you will, this is going to be the forerunners of the European peoples. Skip down to verse number 6. The sons of Ham were Bacon and Sausage. No. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mitzarim, that's Egypt, Put, and Canaan, if you will. That's going to be your lands of Africa, Northern Africa. Skip down in the interest of time. Let's go to verse number 8. Now Cush begot Nimrod. If you have room in your margin there, you know what his name means? I will rebel. It's not a good name. Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. A bit of an unfortunate translation. That's the Hebrew word panim, and it literally means in the face of. Well, he was before the Lord, but he had a clenched fist and poking at the Lord. I don't like you, and I don't want to have anything to do with you. He's living up to his namesake. I will rebel. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter in the face of the Lord. Now, skip over to chapter 11. Chapter 11, we'll start at verse 1. A little more to the story. By the way, if you chase down where all these folks ended up, you can find out where in modern anthropology, where the foundations of a lot of these people were. Now, chapter 11, verse 1. Now, the whole world had one language and one speech. And it came to pass that as they journeyed from the east, did I mention where he cited? Oh, I'm sorry. We should go back to chapter 10. Pardon me. Back to chapter 10, verse 10. And the beginning of his, Nimrod's kingdom was, there it is, Babel. This is where it begins. Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and the land of Shinar. Shinar is this region. Babylon and Babel and the plains of Shinar, a.k.a. the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. From that land, he went to Assyria and he built Nineveh. So the two cities, main cities that hated everything that God was about, were founded by Nimrod. Now chapter 11. Verse 1. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. I don't know for sure, but I bet that speech was Hebrew. I'm just tossing it out there, Mike, for whatever reason. Verse 2. And it came to pass that as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar. You can write in your margin here, the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, you know what? Let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They had brick for stone and they had asphalt for mortar. Read that, if you will, petrochemical goings on. We know today that that region, if you go to the west where it says Media, that's Iran. You go a little bit to the south, there is Elam. What is south of this region here? There it says Arabia, but we know that that is Saudi Arabia. It's largely from verses like this where they begin to prospect for oil. Did they find some oil in this region? They surely did. Did you know that before Saudi Arabia was really developed, you know who the number one oil producing country in the world was? Texas. It really was. And so there are fascinating studies and stories of men who were searching the scriptures and saw this actual reference. Asphalt, huh? And they dig into the root words and it's petrochemical bubblings. Bubbling. And all that kind of stuff. So they begin to dig in this region, or I should say drill in this region. Now, is this region known for oil and petrochemical products? It surely is, and here it is in the Bible, verse 4. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is to the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves. If you've ever noticed that when a nation kind of establishes itself, flexes its muscles, nobody's going to mess with us, and we have a certain economy booming and growing, what's one of the first thing a prosperous nation does? It builds a tower. America was no different. Anyway, let's build it and make a name for ourselves. Why do people build towers? To make a name for themselves. Lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Hold on, time out. Didn't the Lord say, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth? This is the first dictator. This is Nimrod saying, no, 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 let's don't go out there. Come all under my auspices, under my authority. Let me run the show. This is the first dictator. Verse 5, but the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. In the back of your mind, you may be remembering a verse. No man has ever seen God and lived. Well, is this the Father walking around? Probably not. Guess who this likely is? This is one of those pre-incarnate appearances of Jesus. What? He's not born yet. Remember how time works. For us, it's linear, past, present, and future, and it never stops, and you can't get off the train. But where God lives, as Missler liked to say, it's not that he has a lot of time. Where God lives, there is no time. Time itself is a function of the creation. It is affected by gravity and velocity. You've heard me talk about that a lot. So when Jesus resurrected in his new resurrected body, he hung out for 40 days, and then he ascended into heaven. And then Psalm 110 says, come and sit at my right hand, and I will, until I make your enemies your footstool. That was prophetic for Revelation 19. So Jesus, in his resurrected body, is hanging out with the Lord, where there is no time. In his resurrected body, potentially, I don't know how it works exactly, but potentially, in his resurrected body, can he dip back into the timeline? It appears so. And so, relative to us, it's past, but his resurrected body can jump into the past, even pastier than that past. That's probably who this is, verse 6. And the Lord said, indeed, the people, the humans, are one, and they have one language, and this is what they begin to do. So what's he going to do here? He's going to confound the language. And then the term Babel, which means gate to God. Did you know that? The word Babylon means gate to God. Nimrod wanted to build it God, little g, my God, our gods. And God is going to turn the name around Babel and actually allow it to mean the exact opposite. Instead of form and order and an equidistant or equal wonderful progression toward the living God and truth, let's turn that word around, and now what does the word Babel mean? Look what happens when the humans get their languages together and their minds together. He's going to change the languages. Parenthetically, with the advent of the internet, have you noticed there are programs online? You speak, of course, it words it out in English. There's also programs you speak, and it prints it out in what? Whatever language you want. It's in fact the reversal. And what are all the humans going to do when they get their languages back together via the internet? We're going to build another Babylon. I'll show you here in just a minute. The Lord said, verse 6, indeed the people are one and they have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they purpose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us, notice your capital U there, there's your Trinity, there's your compound unity, one God in three manifestations, if you will, I don't know, three different uniforms. Let us go down there, confuse their language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad and there from there over the face of all the earth, which is what he asked them to do in the first place. And they ceased building the city. Verse 9, therefore the name is called Babel, or the Tower of Babel, confusing the language, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. Now I want you to go to Zechariah chapter 5, Old Testament, one of the minor prophets, Zechariah chapter 5, more to the story. Zechariah chapter 5, I have to use my cheaters for that. Zechariah after the book of Haggai. Let's go to chapter 5. Now, what happens? I got a couple more slides for you. Go ahead now, if you would, Blake. Here's an artist's rendition of the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. This is based on excavations that were done in the foundations. The water you see shining in front of you, that's a portion of the river Euphrates. Notice the multi-levels and then the palm trees and flora and fauna on different floors. This was the famous Hanging Gardens of the ancient world, considered one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. How did they get water up there? There was an ingenious system of pulleys and water wheels all run by slaves. And here was a functioning palace, and it had literal microclimates within this massive, massive palace. Notice on the bottom the depiction of the lion with wings and a number of tributes to their big god, Marduk. Go ahead. We'll go around here. Here's another artist's rendition based on archaeology. Archaeology, by the way, about the 1850s and following. Well, what happened to this magnificent city? Well, as you know, in Daniel, Babylon was all that in a bag of chips. And it was the most powerful nation on the planet at the time. Nebuchadnezzar is the one who defeated Jerusalem and then deports in three deportations the exiles of Israel to Babylon. There's the Euphrates River running through the city because they knew if we were ever laid siege to, one of the things that the sieging army does, cutting off your Walmart trucks, is they try to cut off the water supply. Babylon is built right over the Euphrates, and there are a number of areas where the walls went right over the river itself. If you could dry up the mighty Euphrates, ha, fat chance, no one will ever do that. This is an artist's rendition. Hit the go button. I think I got an arrow for you. See that arrow right there? That's one of the gates on the north inside. That's called the Gate of Ishtar, and if you can see, as it trails down to the left-hand side of the slide, that was called the promenade. I think I have a better picture of it. Go ahead, Blake. Here's a shot of it here. Notice the beautiful blue baked brick. It was an enamel of some kind that they invented. And that beautiful blue color would have been quite a stark difference from everybody's beige of the day. We have vibrant colors today in the mercantile business because of the fancy dyes that we have. But in this day, not really. Almost your entire life was basically various shades of beige. So if you were to walk upon this great promenade with all of these beige bricks, it would have been quite stunning. This is approximately 600 BC. What happens to Babylon? Well, the Persians get together with the Medes under a fellow by the name of Cyrus. And they are going to lay siege to the city, but Cyrus knows that the walls of Babylon, they really weren't low like these are depicted. We have a pretty good estimation that those walls were over 200 feet high. That's 20 floors. Some say 300. And the walls were so wide that they often would race chariots four abreast across the top of the wall. It was a It was a formidable city. And if I remember correctly, Koldewey from Germany, he was the first one who actually found the foundations of the entire perimeter of the city. And it was 9 miles round. It was a pretty good sized city. Well, Babylon, after Nebuchadnezzar, was sort of waning in power. The next guy to come up is a fellow by the name of Nabonidus. And he was basically always going out of town on raiding campaigns of various kinds. And he left his knucklehead son in charge, a guy by the name of Belshazzar. You may remember him from Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar is no Nebuchadnezzar. And so when he catches wind of the mighty Cyrus, the Persian king, throwing in with the Medes, he says, "Let him come." And in fact, he throws a great big party, Daniel chapter 5. And they run out of solo red cups. And so what they do is they say, "We'll go into the treasury of Nebuchadnezzar, my grandfather, and dig out some of those Hebrew cups and saucers because we'll drink alcohol from them." Not because they needed more cups, but because they thought they were that cool and the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was no God at all. If you remember the story, they're partying, and then all of a sudden, bing, this hand shows up, and a finger starts writing on the wall. And I love that phrase in Daniel 5. "And the king's knees smote one against the other, and his bowels were loosed." Do you know what that means? He needed a diaper. He was very scared. What's going to happen? Nobody can read this. And then the queen mother, some say it's Nebuchadnezzar's wife. We don't know who it was exactly, but she did know the great king Nebuchadnezzar. She goes, "I know who can read this." And so they get Daniel. By this time, Daniel may be in his 90s or even later. He comes and he says, "You're a fool, Belshazzar, a fool. You're partying when you should have been preparing for the attack of King Cyrus. And I'll tell you what that writing means. Mene tekel upharsin. You have been weighed and you have been found wanting. And tonight you are going to die. And in one night, this magnificent city is going to turn over to the Medo-Persians, King Cyrus, with hardly a bow shot." How did that happen? When Koldewey was digging around, you see behind there, you see the big sort of stepped pyramid. That's Marduk's place there. And so when he was digging, he found the foundation of the temple to Marduk. And when he's digging around in there, he found half of a cylinder. It was the Nabonidus cylinder. And then he found one that was actually, at one time, a wet piece of clay that was imprinted with cuneiform. And then he found the other half and put them together. And there was the history of how Cyrus, did he bash through the 200-foot high walls? You know what he did? Upriver of the Euphrates, in a place called Opus, he had his many soldiers lay down their weapons and pick up picks and shovels, and they diverted much of the flow of the Euphrates River into the canal system at Opus. And while Belshazzar was partying, Cyrus's commandos are waiting till the river drops to the height of a man's thigh. They went under the wall, sawed through some iron bars, ran around to the Ishtar gate. There were other gates, and they opened them, and the waiting Medo-Persian Empire walked right in through the Ishtar gates and captured all of the Babylonian troops in one night. They found Mr. Belshazzar. Guess what they did? Off with his head. Just like Daniel said. Well, then Cyrus is in control for a while. And then after him, after the Medo-Persians, we're going to have the Greeks. Alexander the Great rolls into this great city. And upon conquest, he says, "This is the most fabulous city I've ever seen." They had hot and cold running water. They had hot tubs piped into some of the private homes. It was the most advanced city mathematically, entertainment. It was the Vegas of its day. Who would want to leave this place? Alexander is so impressed that he says, I'm going to move my capital from Greece to Babylon. But he's staying in Nebuchadnezzar's palace, and he dies mysteriously one night, probably murdered. Well, then the kingdom goes to his four generals, and then sort of what happens is by the time you get to 600 AD, thereabouts, you have the whole sort of Islamic control of this region. And by the time they're in control, nobody really lived in Babylon. There were some churches here. In fact, the eastern main sort of seat, the bishop, was at Babylon. But by and large, by the time the Islamics are in control, it just sort of got vacated. And the walls sort of came down of their own accord for lack of maintenance. Babylon was never fully conquered and ultimately destroyed. We're going to see that tonight in chapter 13. So this all sort of just decomposed into the desert sand. There's the Ishtar Gate, those blue tiles, as I've said. In 1850, thereabouts, Robert Caldaway gets to digging, and he starts finding blue stone after, not stone really, but blue brick after blue brick. And you know what he does? He packs it all up, and he sends it back to Berlin. And now, go ahead, here it is. There, by and large, are the original enameled bricks of the Ishtar Gate. That's in the Pergamum Museum in Berlin. That's astounding. Isn't it nice that they sort of get it all polished up for the tourists? This is how he found it. Go ahead. Got a closer look. There's the scale of how those walls look. Imagine the tallest thing you ever saw in your life at this time would be a palm tree. Imagine coming up on this fine edifice. Do I have one more shot? I think I have a close-up. Here again are the lions with wings. That's going to be very important to Daniel's prophecies in Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. What do we got next? Go ahead. This is Babylon today. This is 70-ish miles south of Baghdad. Well, it looks pretty good to me. Well, here's what happened. You remember that despot who used to be running the show in Iraq, Saddam Hussein? He sort of fancied himself as kind of the next great Persian king, Cyrus. So he embarked upon an ambitious building campaign and was in the course and in the process of actually rebuilding the city of Babylon. How far did he get? Go to the next slide. Here is a palace that he had reconstructed. It's been a long time, but in the early 90s, do you remember the night of shock and awe? Many of the air raids were taking place, of course, in Baghdad, and a few missiles were targeted at this structure here. Why is this so fascinating? It's one of the palaces of Saddam Hussein. However, after meticulous archaeology, he deduced that that was the tell, was the hill where Nebuchadnezzar's actual palace stood. He was convinced. And what's chilling about that, go to our next slide. Here's the U.S. Army personnel. As you know, we won that battle. And then we are trying to make a transitional government even to this day. But this is an American soldier cruising through the inside of that palace. What gives me chill bumps is the notion that theoretically, those walls are literally built on the ancient foundation of Nebuchadnezzar's palace. Remember that first artist rendition I showed you? And the very writing on the wall might have been within the confines of the structure. You can see it's a magnificent building. Well, Saddam Hussein kind of got carried away and he lost his head about that. He literally did. Go ahead to our next slide. Here's a fascinating side-by-side. In the background, there's the walls of Saddam Hussein. In the foreground, there is some of the ancient bricks of the old wall of Nebuchadnezzar. And if they are dating back to Hammurabi, those bricks in the foreground literally could be 3,500 years old. Fascinating. Why did Saddam Hussein want to rebuild Babylon? Are you in Zechariah chapter 5? I don't think he believed this, but we know that it's going to happen. Babylon, we're going to read a section in Revelation chapter 18, the demise of a great, great, great city. It's so astounding, this Babylon that the Antichrist will inhabit, that when it goes down in 1 hour, all of the people who aren't saved just can't believe it's gone. And because of the descriptions of sea-going vessels and sea commanders and such, many people thought, well, it must be New York City. Maybe that's where Antichrist is going to put his capital in. No, it won't be. Where is the Antichrist going to build his great city? Where else? Where did it start? On the plains of Shinar, on the Euphrates River. You sure about that, Steve? Are you in Zechariah chapter 5? Check it out. Look at verse 5. Zechariah, a prophet of God, verse 5. Then the angel who talked with me came out and said to me, lift up your eyes now and see what this is that goes forth. Okay. So I asked, well, what is it? And he said, it's a basket that is going forth. He said also, this is their resemblance throughout the earth. Verse 7. Here is a lead disc, in other words, kind of a lid on top of this basket. Lift it up. Now go ahead and look inside. And he does. And this is a woman sitting inside the basket. Okay, unusual. Verse 8. Then he said, you know who this woman is? This is wickedness. Right in your margin here, Revelation 17, verse 3. And he, the angel, thrust her down into the basket, and he threw the lid or the lead covering over its mouth. Then I raised my eyes and looked, and there were two women coming with the wind in their wings. Are they angels? No, here comes a clue. For they had wings like the wings of a stork. Right in your margin here, this is Leviticus 11, verse 19. Storks are unclean, non-kosher birds. If you're privy to Levitical sort of language, these ladies in their wings, this is not a good thing here. There's a sense of evil foreboding. So they had wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the basket between heaven and earth. Here it goes. It's an airlift. Well, where are they going? Verse 10. So I said to the angel who talked with me, where are they carrying the basket? And he said to me, to build a what? A house for it. I thought it was a her. Nope. Who is this woman? Revelation 17 tells us. This is the harlot. This is Mystery Babylon. Mystery of Babylon is the religious system that will coalesce after the rapture. It's going to be made up of Christians, of churches who didn't need a new pastor after the rapture, if you know what I'm talking about. It's also going to be the Islamics are going to fall in, the ecumenicals potentially falling in, maybe the Roman Catholics, I don't know. But by the time we're done, the Buddhists and the Confucianist people and all the religions and the Mormons and everybody else are going to come together under one ecumenical religious expression, Mystery Babylon. We're going to see that in a minute in Revelation 17. That's the spiritual side. At first, it's riding the Antichrist. In other words, the Antichrist himself is instrumental in getting her this stronghold over all the earth. But then halfway through, what happens? The Antichrist turns around and devours her. Now he's saying, forget all that other nonsense. There's one God, and the Antichrist says, it's me. It's a human demon-possessed by Lucifer himself. And Lucifer has always wanted what? The worship and the adoration that belongs to God only. He tried to get Jesus to worship him. Jesus was well taught. Back to verse 11, Zechariah 5. And he, the angel, said to me, where are they going? I'll tell you, to build a house for it in the land of Shinar. Where is that? That's the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. That's Babylon. When it is ready, the basket will be set there on its base. Babylon, that is famous in Daniel chapter 5 and the pictures that I showed you, was the formidable city of its day. Who was it founded by? Nimrod. What was its purpose? To do everything against what God wants. Jerusalem is God's city. It seems to be there's an anti-city, and it was started by the first human, the first prototype Antichrist. It will again be built. Are you sure? Got a couple other pictures for you. You ready, Blake? You ready? You guys want to go on a vacation? Ooh, let's go to the Persian Gulf. Let's go to Dubai. Go ahead. There is a picture of Dubai. Let's go ahead and dim our lights a little bit so you can get a good look at it. That's astounding. That building, what happened? Who twisted it? Some of the greatest architects in the world have conspired to build Dubai. You can see a picture, if you have really good eyes, past that little area of this lagoon, man-made lagoon. You'll see water. That's the Persian Gulf. If you have really good eyes, about 100 miles that way is Iran. You're very close to what's called the Strait of Hormuz. You want to see another picture of Dubai, Dubai City, I should say, which is in a country called the United Arab Emirates. This picture is absolutely breathtaking. Anybody who's actually visited Dubai City, they can't stop talking about how astounding it is. What's amazing about this picture is I have a love of architecture and I have a love of tall buildings. I've studied many of these structures. That very tallest building there is one of the top five tallest buildings on the planet. And there are different buildings on either side, and included in that group is the tallest hotel in the world, the tallest business tower in the world, the tallest this in the world, the tallest Starbucks in the world. It's all right there. What's fascinating about this specific skyline is all of these structures were completed in less than 7 years. Well, you mean oil money did all of that? Not really. This is business money and investors of the private sector. This is not United Arab Emirate oil money by and large. What's fascinating is what you see here largely was completed within a 7-year period by tremendous investment momentum. The reason I'm kind of making this point is, could the Antichrist, once he has seized control of everything, how much of the world's economy will he control? In Revelation 13, you can't buy or sell without his mark. And he's taking a piece of it all. That skyline, as impressive as it is, that skyline contains 3 or 4 of the top 10 tallest buildings on the planet. And it was made by business ventures, by and large. What could the Antichrist accomplish with unlimited wealth? And how fast could he do so? I got another picture for you. Go ahead. There, of course, is the Burj Khalifa. That's the tallest building on the planet. It's 2,716.5 feet tall. It's 160 towers. And of course, Tom Cruise hung out on the edge of it in that wonderful movie, Ghost Protocol. You want to stay at a hotel? I got just the one you might want to see. Go ahead. Let's stay here. Look at that. That's the Burj Dubai Hotel, about 800 feet off of the shore. That's the Persian Gulf there. You'll see there's a swim complex behind. It's shaped in the form of a billowing sail. It took them 1.5 years just to build the post and piling foundation that entire structure would stand up on or would be up on. Hit the go button. There's a little circle right there. I don't know if you can see it, but that's the helipad. The helipad is 950 feet above the ocean right there. That's astounding. That lobby, that white stripe across the front, that's the lobby. The lobby from the bottom to the top, unobstructed, is an 800-foot vista. It's an astounding piece of work. Can you play sports there? Yeah, go ahead. You can play tennis. Nobody's gasping out loud. That's astounding. By the way, that's the helipad I just showed you about. But somebody had the great notion, let's put a full-size tennis court in there and get some pictures of a couple pros whacking a tennis ball. How many of you say, I don't think I want to. You go get the ball. I'm not going to go get the ball on that one. That's the helipad. Go to your next slide. What's this? This is a palm-shaped island. There are a couple of these. I want to say there are three, but there's at least a couple. Every bit of dirt you see there was trucked in and poured into place by man-made machines. It's in the shape, of course, of a palm. That's astounding. What do those palms look like? You want to drive down one of the streets? Go ahead. That's what the palms are made of. Made of multi-million dollar, 6, 7, 8, 10,000 square foot homes. And as you can see, many of them with pools. That is Dubai and Dubai City. And that, by and large, was made. Last slide. Here's that astounding skyline. I want you to notice that much of this unimaginably opulent city was built by a few businessmen in less than 7 years. I could take you to an indoor ski resort. Did you say snow? Yes, I did. I could take you to a number of other buildings that are being planned. Let's leave this up for a minute, bring our lights back up. I wanted to show you Dubai City. I wanted to show you what the industrial nature of humans with enough money and enough workforce in place, what can happen from desert sand in less than 7 years. All right. Now go, if you would, to the book of Revelation, chapter 18. Revelation 18. Are we even going to get to chapter 13 tonight? You better hurry. Let's go to chapter 18. Chapter 17 in the Revelation is that harlot that I was telling you about. Look down there in chapter 17. Who is the woman? Look at 17, verse 5. And on her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. She's a representation of every false religion that has ever started. By the way, who founded every false and occultic spiritual practice? Who? Lucifer did. Where? It all started on the plains of Shinar. Now chapter 18, verse 1. Now the economic Babylon, verse 1, Revelation 18. And after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having a great authority. And the earth was illuminated by his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great! I believe it's not New York City. It's not London. It's not any prosperous port city like Hong Kong. I personally believe it is on the shores of the Euphrates River. Whoa, whoa, whoa. We're going to see here in a minute ocean-going vessels. Yeah. Did you know that there were ocean-going vehicles coming up the Euphrates River in Nebuchadnezzar's day? And when he died, Alexander the Great had already drafted blueprints to dredge the Euphrates River and allow for ocean-going vessels. If you've ever studied the construction of the Suez Canal, mostly sand and sand deposits, they chewed through the Suez Canal in a matter of months, really, and the Suez Canal is a lot less miles than Babylon is from the mouth of the Persian Gulf. There will be ocean-going vehicles traversing their way to Babylon. Babylon the Great has fallen. The seven seals have popped. The seven trumpets have blown. The seven bowl judgments are complete. It's done. Here comes God. And the first thing he's going to do is destroy Babylon. The Antichrist with unlimited resources have built. Verse 2, he cried mightily with a loud voice, Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison for every foul spirit and a cage for every unclean, hated bird. Hey, what was that stork? Is a stork an unclean bird? That's right. This is pinning the two together. Being Lucifer's headquarters, okay, it's a pretty demonic place. Demons are in control, and the humans love being nasty together. So it's a match made in heaven. Verse 3, or I should say a match made in hell. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her, fornication, mystery of Babylon, the woman in the basket. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. The merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Sin is big business, you guys. People at the top are getting rich. People at the bottom are getting exploited and crushed. It's survival of the fittest. It's not a good place to live. Verse 4. And I heard another voice, another angel from heaven saying, come out of her, my people. Who's that? This is probably your tribulation saints at this point. Time to get out of there. Or it also could be people who have received the Lord and have still somehow not taken the mark, flown under the radar of the Antichrist who's living in this city. You better get out lest you share in her sins, unless you receive her plagues. Verse 5, and her sins have reached heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Hey God, render unto her just as she rendered to you. Remember, the Antichrist and friends have destroyed so many of God's people. And repay her double according to her works. That whole awful system. In the cup which she has mixed, we've learned about that. That's the blood of all the saints, the people of God. Mixed for her double, verse 7. And in the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she has said in her heart, I sit as queen. I am no widow. Everybody loves me and will not see sorrow. Sin is not going to have its way with me. Or the sin's judgment, I should say, is not going to get me. Verse 8, therefore her plagues will come in one day. Death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire. For strong is the Lord God who judges her. Now, who is going to destroy Babylon? Is it going to be angelic? Is it going to be supernatural like Sodom and Gomorrah? It could be. But also at this time, remember, Antichrist's huge army is fragmenting. Why? Because evidently demons under the devil are rebelling. Remember, the Battle of Armageddon is a four-army conflict. The Antichrist European forces with the king of the south, the king of the north, and the king of the east. Lucifer's own army is fragmenting. Is it one of them? We just don't know. Verse 9, the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning. Standing at a distance for fear of her torment. When it goes up, it's going to be powerful. Don't get near it. Look what they're saying. Not, Lord, we're sure sorry for our sin and all the sin that goes on there. Nope. Alas, alas, the great city of Babylon. That mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. Verse 11. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn for her. Why? Because she's the center of all banking and all economy. For no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls. The riches of the people that they'd worked so hard for, gone. Fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet. All the cool clothes they worked so hard for, gone. Every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, of every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, marble, all the home decorations, gone. The cinnamon and incense, the fragrant oil and frankincense, the wine and the oil, if you will, the cosmetics people work so hard for, gone. Fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep, all the sumptuous meals, gone. Horses and chariots, if you will, the military might that people spent so with such abandon, gone. And the bodies and the souls of men, This is pretty rough stuff. This is the sex trade. This is the porn and the lust that people are so consumed with in this city. Not Dubai City, but whatever Babylon will be gone. Verse 14, the fruit of your soul longed for has gone from you, and all the things which are rich and splendid have gone for you, and you shall find them no more at all. And the merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing and saying, oh, alas, alas, that great city. Can you imagine all the man hours and all the expertise? I didn't show you some of the gold-gilded swimming pools in that hotel with the sail thing. I didn't take you up to the 67th floor where there's an Olympic-sized swimming pool that's gilded in literal gold. You look out of your swimming pool and 60 floors down. Can you imagine? Humans work so hard. Look what we can do. You know what this is? You know what Babylon will be? It will be human attempt for a new Jerusalem. And the very best construction, design, art that humans can do, when they get done, they'll puff their chests out and swell with pride. Look at that. In 1 hour, gone. What a of human endeavor. Verse 17, for in 1 hour such great riches have come to nothing. Every shipmaster and all who travel by ship, sailors as many as trade on the sea, they stood at a distance. This is what has made many believe maybe it's New York City, maybe it's Hong Kong. No, it's going to be on the plains of Shinar. It's going to be Babylon, 70 miles roughly south of current day Baghdad. And cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what is like this great city? Verse 19. They threw dust on their heads and they cried out weeping and wailing and saying, alas, alas, the great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich from her wealth. And in 1 hour, she is made desolate. Rejoice over her, heaven. The humans who are going to hell, they think the greatest tragedy of all is losing a Vegas-type city. They have no idea what it's like when they will land in hell. Rejoice over her, heavenly people. This is us in heaven with the Lord. You who holy apostles and prophets, remember, we're going to come down with Jesus in Revelation 19. Before we do, we're going to say, finally, the city that the Antichrist built on the backs of slaves is gone. Verse 21, then a mighty angel took up one stone like a great millstone, threw it into the sea, perhaps the Persian Gulf, and saying, thus with violence the great city of Babylon will be thrown down and shall not be found anymore. The sound of harpists, musicians, and flutists, and trumpeteers shall not be heard in you anymore forever. No craftsman of any craft shall be found in you anymore forever. And the sound of a millstone, which is the commonest household appliance, because you had to always grind the grain to make the flour that was always going, that's not going to happen to her forever. And the light, verse 23, of a lamp shall not shine in you forever. And the voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall not be heard in you forever. For your merchants were the great men of the earth at one time. And for by your sorcery, all the nations were deceived. There was supernatural stuff happening through the false prophet. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and the saints and all who were slain on the earth. Now, Isaiah 13. I don't know how far we'll get. Isaiah chapter 13, please. And now with all that in the backdrop, Isaiah chapter 13, verse 1. Let's hurry, Mike. The burden against Babylon, chapter 13, Iraq. This is Isaiah now. The burden against Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. Lift up a banner on the high mountain. Raise your voice to them. Wave your hand that they may enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for my anger. Those who rejoice in my exaltation. God is calling up an army. Is it going to be angels? We don't know. Remember, most prophecy in your Bible has a near fulfillment, in this case, the real Babylon that was still in existence, and then it has a farther fulfillment, in this case, the city that Antichrist will build. Verse 4. The noise of a multitude of the mountains, like that of many people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of the nations gathered together. Are these human armies? The Lord of hosts. The Lord of hosts is one of his titles. What's the hosts? Those are angels, the angelic army. Musters the army. Is it an army? Is it an angel army? For battle, verse 5, they come from a far country and from the end of heaven. The Lord and his weapons of indignation to destroy the whole land. Babylon is going down. Verse 6, wail for the day that the Lord is at hand. It will come as a destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will be limp. Nobody's going to be able to take up a sword. Every man's heart will melt. No one will have enough courage. And they will be afraid. Pangs of sorrow will take hold of them. And they will be in pain. As a woman in childbirth, they will be amazed at one another. Their faces will be like flames. The near fulfillment, could that be Cyrus 539 B.C.? I don't know that this description is how Cyrus did it. Well, what about the Greeks when they came in? It's still not that descriptive of that time either. I think this is a farther fulfillment of Revelation 18, verse 9. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. He will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened as it's going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. I believe this is in reference to Matthew 24, verse 29, when Jesus was citing Joel, which has to do with descriptions of the great tribulation. Verse 11. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. Why does God allow judgment of any kind? Remember, to shake up the complacent, to wake up those who might have any true heart for him, and then to make up those people that have truly been converted to make up the next season of God's ministry. That's exactly what the book of Revelation is, the great tribulation for the people of Israel. Verse 12. I, by the end of the tribulation, I believe, will make a mortal more rare than fine gold. I believe that also is a description of the end portion of the great tribulation. Humans have been getting wiped out in unprecedented numbers by the billions. By the way, how do you get fine gold? From the fire. A man more than a golden wedge of Ophir. That was a region where fine gold was manufactured. Verse 13. Therefore I will shake the heavens and the earth will move out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts and in the day of his fierce anger. Do you know that currently planet Earth is our axis is tilted 23 and a third degrees. What happened? You've heard us talk about probably the long day of Joshua and also that time when the Hezekiah's sundial shadow moves backwards 10 plus degrees. We've got teachings on that. I believe that's either in reference to a near pass by of the planet Mars. If that's interesting to you, we've got teachings on that. In other words, you know that the planets are elliptical in their orbit. They're not circular. And according to ancient records of earthquakes, there were 108-year increments when every 108 years, tremendous destruction visited planet Earth. You've also heard me describe that ancient societies have described two moons surrounding Mars. Do you know that there are two moons surrounding Mars, and they named them Fear and Panic, Phobos and Deimos? Did you know that there are, in fact, two small moons in front of Mars, but they weren't actually seen until the early 1800s? How did Gulliver's Travel describe two moons the Lilliputian astronomers could find? It's very likely that planet Mars was on a more severe elliptical orbit at one time. And by estimation of some of these NASA scientists, if so, it would account for a 108-year increment of Mars getting so close to the Earth that you could potentially see Phobos and Deimos moving across the face of Mars with the naked eye. I don't know. But what happens? Is God is going to straighten out the axis of the Earth? I don't know. Verse 14, and at Babylon shall be as a hunted gazelle and as a sheep. That is to say, they're defenseless. That no man takes up. Every man will turn to his own people. Everyone will flee to his own land. And everyone, every Babylonian, who is found will be thrust through. And everyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Again, not descriptive of Cyrus's conquest or of Alexander's. I believe this is a description of, a further description of Revelation 18, verse 16. Their children will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. That's awful. Their houses will be plundered, their wives ravaged. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them. Now we're talking some history. This is fascinating to me. Because the power of Isaiah's time were not the Medes. The Medes were nomads at this time. They're not going to get big until 200 more years. Why didn't Isaiah say the Assyrians? That's who's going to come give Hezekiah a heart attack. He doesn't say so. Why? Because he's a prophet of God. It's not going to be the Assyrians. The Medo-Persians under Cyrus will conquer Babylon. Verse 17, behold, I will stir up the Medes against them who will not regard silver. As for gold, they will not delight in it. They're not there for money. They're there for expansion of power. That's what Cyrus did. Verse 18, also their bows will dash the young men to pieces, and they will have no pity on the fruit of the womb. They're going to wipe out kids too. Their eye will not spare children. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, at that time, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride at that time will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. That hasn't happened yet. I believe this is a far fulfillment. Revelation 18, watch for the final descriptions. Verse 20, it will never be inhabited. Babylon was inhabited after the Medo-Persians, after the Greeks, through the Christian era, and even up until the nomadic eras of the Islamics, there were always people living there. I believe this now is in reference to Revelation 18. When God gets done wiping out the Antichrist Babylon, now nobody is ever going to live there again. Nor will it be settled from generation to generation. Nor will the Arabian pitch tents there. They were nomadic people, not anymore. Nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there. But the wild beasts of the desert will lie there, and their houses will be full of owls and ostriches. Read that wildlife that is skittish around humans. And wild goats will caper there. The hyenas will howl in their citadels, and the jackals in their pleasant palaces. That's the Babylon that gets wiped out by God. Her time is near to come, and her days will not be prolonged. This is Dubai City. Much of that was constructed in less than 7 years from desert sand. Can you imagine what the Antichrist will do with unlimited wealth? Let's all stand. See, Mike, you didn't think we were going to finish, but we did. Thank you, Lord Jesus, for Isaiah chapter 13. Next week, we're going to talk about the demonic force behind Babylon. Jesus, you are the Prince of Peace. Jeru Shalom. Jerusalem is named after you. Babylon was founded by Lucifer himself through a series of humans. It will be built again. Where? On the shores of the Euphrates River in the valley and plain of Shinar. Yeah, but there's not much there now. Oh, there will be. So if you're seeing this or hearing this at some later date and jillions of people have disappeared and you're watching the feverish pace of the most magnificent city humans have ever created, please know it's a faltering attempt at the new Jerusalem. And it will be destroyed in 1 hour. Jesus, I want to thank you that coming is the new Jerusalem, not built by human hands. How was it said? You built earth in 6 days. You've been working on heaven for 2,000 years. Come quickly, Lord Jesus, please. Come and get us. But until that time, may we be people who are ready for your return and ready to give an account of the joy that's in us. Let us, anybody you bring, Lord, let us talk about Bible prophecy, the soon return of Jesus Christ. I pray these things in Jesus' name. And everybody said, amen. 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 See you on Sunday, everybody.